Want is made up of, three is made up of ability, desire, and knowledge, but lacks the specific thought. Should is made up of knowledge, ability, and thought, but lacks desire. The importance of that is what happens is the mind sort of mixes them together to try to find out, all right, now, where is the inequity? I will measure my cans and my wants, my needs and my shoulds, and determine where there is the imbalance, or my cans and my shoulds. See, if I have something that I can do and I should do, well then, pretty much, unless I have a very, very strong want in another direction, I might likely do it at that point. Or if I have a want and a need, there I've got, let's see, a can and a should. I have a can and a need. Well, no, if I have a can and a need, then I'll probably do it. If I have a want and a should, then I'll probably do it. Whereas if I have a can and a should, doesn't really, it's a wash, because I may not have the, I might have the ability, but I don't have the desire. And if I have a need and a want, well, I have the desire, but I don't have the ability. So at that point, I don't have enough information if it's between those to tell exactly what to do. So the next thing I do is I'll just bump it up one more level. Again, the purpose of which is for more information. So what I then do is I will take those and bump them into state of being, situation, condition, sense of self. The purpose now is to look at not what I can, how I am, but look at the outside world, the physical universe, and see, okay, I've not really been able to determine in my mind, which is the thought, knowledge, ability, and desire. I haven't really been able to determine if it's something with that I personally can do. So now how, maybe it's something in my physical universe that will help to actually give me the deciding factor as to which decision I should make. So I look at my state of being, I look at my situation, I look at who I think I am, my sense of self, and I look at my condition, or how other people think of me and how I think of other people. And I see if it's balanced or if it is not balanced. And if it's not balanced, where does that imbalance fall? If that is still out of balance at that point, I only have one more step I can go, and I will do that. I will move on up into future-oriented justification. Now, what these are commitment, obligation, responsibility, and rationalization. Remember, each step, each level I go up in the justification tree, I blend three of the other before to create one element at that level. So by the time I'm up at commitment, obligation, responsibility, and rationalization, there is a very, very fine line between the two. And it's very easy to get them mixed up. But the point is that at this point, it's really hard to see the distinction between them. And I might find that if I make a commitment, by making a commitment, it may then appear to balance my rationalization. Or if I make an obligation, that might balance out the inequity between that and my responsibility. The point is that when I get up to these blended levels, it's a lot easier to live with the inequity through time to hopefully collect more data or let time resolve the inequity on its own.
As Chris was speaking, right-minded look at this occurred to me. If we look at the four items of preconscious, conscious, memory, and subconscious, they're almost like different resistances to changing something. There are different levels at which information can lodge within the mind. The most available to change by a changing environment is preconscious. Essentially, at that level, it's immediately manipulated by anything that comes in from the environment, any type of sensory input. You look at the conscious level, and that's not directly manipulated by the environment, but it's manipulated by the preconscious. And so anything that happens in observation must interact with the preconscious, and then it affects the conscious, where the consideration is. Once the conscience has dealt with something, then it will move it into memory, and it will download itself into memory, where it will place that information that it believes to be true. And if something is in memory and is fixated there without being changed and maneuvered around, it becomes set in the subconscious as a basic understanding or operating system for the brain, and requires an awful lot to dislodge it. Because in order for that to be changed by external forces, something down in the subconscious, it has to work its way all the way through preconscious, conscious, memory, and subconscious to get to it. In one sense, we have a problem or inequity built in the subconscious. Then it must work its way up into memory, conscious, and preconscious to be out of the system. But the only way that can happen is for an observation, a changed universe, to work its way down from preconscious to conscious to memory to subconscious to show that there's a problem. And then at that point, that can be resolved because that pathway has been opened to the universe again instead of shut off. Now, one functionality of it is that since the preconscious and every one of the succeeding levels is evaluated in terms of the thought, knowledge, ability, and desire of our own mind looking at these levels, that when an inequity appears between our mind and the universe, it shows up in the preconscious, and we first evaluate it in terms of looking at that preconscious in terms of thought, knowledge, ability, and desire. And we're looking to see if, in the preconscious, the inequity isn't something we know, the inequity is something that we are able to do, the inequity isn't something that we desire, or the inequity is in our thoughts. Now, if we find it at that level, then it's a simple matter for it to resolve itself. This is the level where data comes in and you think you see something, but before it even registers in your consciousness that you think you saw it, your mind reevaluates and says, no, you didn't. This is below the level of conscious awareness, but it is where things are filtered out from our environment. So all the time, things will pop up that say, here is something that, you know, alert, alert, send up a red flag, here is a problem over in the knowledge quad of preconsciousness. And then before that has a chance to send a message to the conscious, that knowledge quad will be brought back into equity because whatever it was that was causing the problem has gone away. That filters out a lot of background noise of the universe that we don't need to deal with because the problems resolve themselves faster than we can become aware of them. And the reason it takes us a while to become aware is so that filtering can go on, because problems of that duration are usually things we can't respond to anyway. And as a result, it's not a survival attribute to have to consciously consider all that. It would occupy the mind all the time. Let's save it for things that are big problems that won't go away. So if something upturns knowledge, for example, and says, what you know is not matching what you're seeing in the preconscious level, and it won't go away, then it knocks it up to the next level in terms of can. And suddenly the whole mind is now operating at a conscious level, saying, there is a problem. But it's not going to look for the problem in terms of need. It's not going to look at the problem in terms of want or should. It's going to assume that the problem is in terms of can, because can, as Chris had mentioned, is made out of desire, thought, and ability, but no knowledge. And because can is made out of those things, and we know that those are not where the problem is, then it is that lack of knowledge that we're examining in can. And so the conscious mind will then turn its attention to that area, and it will say, all right, let's deal with this. If the conscious mind in dealing with it, without going back to memory, or without feeling your motivations from deep within, if the conscious mind says, oh, I see, I thought that was a man crossing the street, but it was just a shadow, you don't need to really access anything. You just identify it, accessing memory vaguely in this case, but you could just look at something and say, I thought I saw something, I did not see it. And if you just don't even identify what it was, but it's there and it's gone and you're consciously aware of it, it's kind of like what you would do in terms of a double take if there wasn't anything really there in comedy. you'd look again, and it wouldn't be there, and you'd shrug your shoulders and go back to what you were doing. That would happen at the conscious level. Now, at that level, if the problem can be resolved, then you know that it was only your consciousness that was fooled. You only had a problem at the conscious level, and that could take care of it. If you cannot solve the problem at that level, since should, want, and need go to make up can, you instead take can and look at it in terms of your state of being instead. You look at it as the entire essence of who you are, and that brings you up to the next level. When you're at that level, you're dealing with memory. And when you deal with memory, you're now asking the question in terms of thought, knowledge, ability, and desire. You're saying, is there something wrong with my memory? Which is, from that perspective, your state of being. You're saying state of being, having been created out of can, out of knowledge, you're questioning part of your state of being there and saying that my memory is suspect. Well, at that point, you have to look at your memory, and perhaps you have a very strong memory of something, or perhaps you have conflicting memories, or perhaps the memory itself has been suspect for some time and this has tipped the balance. If so, you can work out that inequity right there and tip it back the way it should be, and it ripples right back from memory through conscious to preconscious, and there you are again, all is right with the universe. But if you can't tip the balance there in state of being, then you have to move to the next level, because situation, sense of self, and condition are what will create commitment. So you look at commitment, and now you're looking into your subconscious, and you can't do this consciously. That's not visible to your subconscious, but your mind is still working at that level. And the mind will then evaluate the commitment that you have. And that is how knowledge has become can, become state of being, become commitment in this particular sense, in this standard left-minded perspective. And as you evaluate your commitment, if you can change your commitment, then at that point the problem is resolved and it works its way all the way through. But if you can't change your commitment, if you cannot change your commitment and it remains the same, then that inequity remains where it is. In order to have an inequity balanced, commitment is right across from rationalization. And what you actually have to do is you have to upset rationalization to match commitment so that you end up with a balance in your subconscious. When you are upsetting rationalization, you're essentially doing the same thing as turning knowledge back over and saying there is no problem here. Because essentially what happens is turning over rationalization to balance commitment, because it wouldn't change, ripples right back up the system the same way we just rippled down, and ends up flipping thought to flip knowledge, so that knowledge and thought, as far as the conscious can see it, are now in balance again. It's the balance across that X pattern that must be maintained. It's like a seesaw. And if one side goes up, then the other side will go down. But if you can bring the other side back up midway, then you balance the seesaw, even though they both now have a brick on either side. The mind can't see how much weight is on one side or the other. All it can see is if there is a balance there or not. So when you take rationalization and balance it against commitment, it then ripples up one level, because you're going the other direction now, and it balances sense of self with state of being. And then it moves up another level and balances once with cans. And then it balances thought with knowledge. And when you're finally back to the preconscious level, you now have a filter, because you have intentionally, by your subconscious actions, but not conscious intention, you have now created an unbalanced thought to match the unbalanced knowledge. And as long as the information from the universe continues to show that inequity at knowledge, the conscious will never see it as long as thought remains unbalanced. The key to getting to this and solving that is, in a story, the function of the antagonist is to force it to get back to dealing with the inequity where it really is, between you and the universe, back in the preconscious. In order to do this, the approach will be to first wipe out thought, which will then wipe out want, which will then wipe out sense of self, which will then wipe out rationalization, leaving one to have to deal with commitment down to state of being, down to can, down to knowledge, when you can face the problem and then decide consciously. Now, the real key to this is that that method of following from preconscious to conscious to memory to subconscious, that's irregardless of left or right minds. And looking in terms of knowledge and ability, thought, desire, can, need, want, should, condition, state of being, sense of self, commitment, obligation, responsibility, rationalization, all those levels appear to be the same as far as I can tell. But the specific white elements that are involved in those things do appear to be in a different arrangement from a right-minded to a left-minded respect. So in other words, the green levels may not necessarily match up with the blue levels for right and left mind. However, there is a common ground in terms of being able to understand story structure, either as an internal experience or as an external one where you read it in other people and say, yes, that follows what I've seen. And that is the arrangement that we put in our normal or nodal point arrangement of elements on the board. In terms of the external perspective, looking at others, or the universe perspective, the yellow pieces of paper are in that same nodal point position. In our balanced set for left and right minds, where we have our common ground, the position then of the yellows in relationship to the blues, when they are all matched up with the whites that go with them, in this system, everything is proper, everything is balanced out. It either looks correct internally or it looks correct externally, but it doesn't look halfway in between. It doesn't look like something we can't understand either inside ourselves or in somebody else. Those stories are available. Those structures are available. They are a left-minded and a right-minded structure, but they won't reach a joint audience, a combination audience. And so again, our initial thrust is to explore the common ground version, the nodal point version that we call it, which is what we have with this arrangement of yellows and blues and white elements and greens and pinks. Based on that then, the problems that we run into is when one has balanced one's mind, essentially one has moved the mind in relationship to the universe. The way one thinks about oneself is different than the way one thinks about the universe. And if the way we think about the universe essentially is the yellows, and the way we think about ourselves is the blues, an offshoot of this effect of creating within ourselves a balanced inequity is to rotate the yellows in relationship to the blues. By changing thought to balanced knowledge, we're essentially making an adjustment in our own minds that has no basis in the actuality that we have in the outside world. We're messing with our sense of reality and creating a new perception that is not in line with the actual input from reality. When we do that, our view of the universe and our view of ourselves are two different things. And so we are moving the blues in relationship to the yellow. So along with kind of vertical to vertical to the pathway along the quads of whites, moving from thought to want to rationalization, that kind of movement can be seen from another perspective in the movement of the yellows or blues in relationship to each other. Now, as, again, a God's eye view, looking at it as an audience watching a film, we can see the actual order of events in the external world, in the yellow. And we can see the actual linear order of events in the internal world. And when they are not in sync, we can see that as well. And that is the nature of the dilemma. The dilemma, then, is when the blues have been rotated in respect to the yellows as a result of having balanced an internal inequity, an inequity between self and outside, by creating another inequity in self to mask that outside inequity. And the story then revolves around fixing one of those sets, either the blue set for fixing the mind or the yellow set for fixing the universe. Standing on that perspective, exploring the other set, seeing what its order truly is and the way things really are. And once we've determined that, then locking that set at the last moment of decision and saying, now that we've explored that set and know exactly what it looks like, we'll fix it, stand on it, and look back at the other set. In the left-minded film, we have a fixed mindset that has that imbalance in it. And we go out and look at all the yellow sets of the physical world. and we see how all those things are arranged, standing on mind. And when we do, the floating set of the outside universe finally locks into place. When it locks into place, we stand on there, look back at our own minds, and say, now let's evaluate where the problem is within us, because we didn't find the problem out there. When you do, then you have that option at that moment of actually staring at the true inequity. It is taken away, for example, that balancing thought, and let you look from the outside perspective of wisdom at your knowledge problem instead, and say, the problem is in my own knowledge. If you admit to that problem, you can then flip that over and say, I will change my knowledge. And when you do, you've resolved that issue. But if you refuse to change your knowledge because you have an imbalance somewhere else that prevents you from wanting to do that, then at that point, you simply slip it right back to where it was, and you end up with another balance of thought again against it. That's pretty much the functionality of it in terms of two from a right-minded perspective.
Okay. As an alternative way of looking at this, we have previously written down a lay explanation so that it's not going to be necessarily exactly correct, but it will at least be in essence correct. The first step is we have the mind functioning normally in real time, using thought, knowledge, ability, and desire. Second step, through the functioning of the mind, of thinking, we learn that our external situation, our condition, our state of being, and our sense of self can be anticipated. Third step, the mechanism of anticipation is to take a momentary value of thought and apply it to a momentary value of knowledge. Fourth step, the result is an anticipated ability and desire. This is the first level of justification. Step 5. Learning that if an ability and or desire are anticipated, alterations can be made internally and externally to pre-balance for the anticipated inequity. Step 6. When alterations are made, they reflect the anticipated situation or condition, or state of being of self, thereby maintaining a perception that may differ from reality. This is phase 2 of justification. Step 7. As long as no information is perceived that indicates the inequity between perception and reality, the mind is not motivated to correct the inequity because it is completely unaware of it. Step 8. As soon as the mind becomes aware of inequity between perception and reality, it must determine how to balance the inequity by altering the relationship within the mind. Step 9. The mind will evaluate the changes in situation, condition, state of being, and sense of self. It will apply the inequity to each of these in turn, determining a new anticipated ability and or desire in each case. The anticipated ability and desire creating the smallest new inequity between perception and reality is the area chosen to be altered. This is the third level of justification.
That third level referred to, and when you look for the smallest possible inequity, if you had a problem in commitment and you tried to balance it with obligation, it's going to leave some inequity left because it's not directly across. If you try to balance it with responsibility, it's going to leave some inequity left. Because although each one of those items is made up from the other three, that is how they are created, so they're all mutually interrelated and mutually dependent, interdependent, it's only the one directly across that can maintain a balance. And that gives you that seesaw effect, which is where the least possible inequity will result.
The last part of the step 9, which it goes into describing which of the four things would be changed. If you choose to change your situation, that's based on a motivation to change your environment, and that will create an obligation. If you have a motivation to change other people or condition, that creates a responsibility. If you're motivated to change your knowledge, and therefore your perception of reality, that will force you to change, that will allow you to make a commitment.
Yeah.
And if you're motivated to change your thoughts, in other words, to change your motivations, that will lead you to making rationalizations.
One way of looking at it also is to look at the process of moving through the justification tree as firming up something. And eventually when you get firmed up completely on it, you have frozen that and no longer reevaluate it. So that when you take knowledge and you make it a little more firm, you get kim. When you make it a little more firm, you achieve a state of being. And when you lock it in so it's not changing at all, you have a commitment. What's interesting is that when you freeze knowledge and have a commitment, you really can't judge ability, because ability is the change in knowledge. And if on that issue you're refusing to reevaluate knowledge, then you have no way of rating ability. And the same for all of them. When you freeze each one, it will not allow you to measure another one. And altogether, you end up with a very lopsided view from the outside.
One thing that it allows you to do in terms of understanding how to break them down, you cannot break down these third-level justifications from the top. If you attack the commitment, it will either withhold any pummeling, or it will be switched for an alternative commitment, which is, it's the act of being committed or doing a commitment, whatever, having a commitment, is what maintains the inequity, not necessarily the particular object or subject to which you are committed. So therefore, if your justification was commitment, and or if you were looking at somebody else who is committed, the best way to break them down from an antagonist's point of view or from an author's point of view to understand how to break down that commitment is to attack them at their knowledge, to shake their very foundation of their knowledge, because that requires them to reevaluate the whole structure of their commitment as opposed to the existence of their commitment.
All of these items come into play, because when you have a commitment and you balance it with a rationalization, and a commitment prevents rating an obligation because of ability, you can't look at ability because you've frozen knowledge, then by making a rationalization, you're freezing thought and you can't rate desire. When you do those things, you end up with a fixed set that's completely immobile. You're not rating at all ability and desire, and you're balanced between commitment and rationalization. So since now commitment and rationalization are both fixed and self-sustaining, the only thing that can change it is either something external going in directly and altering the nature of the original problem, but that's not what story is all about, so it's not going to attack knowledge. And if you come in and have it dealing with thought as opposed to knowledge, you're going to actually be flipping from one world to the other. But what's most intriguing is when you attack it by flipping into a different mindset instead of another, from a left-minded set to a right-minded set. And if you were to attack it from ability or desire, essentially, then you would be unraveling it in a way that most sneaks up on the individual who has the problem, because those are simply things that are not reevaluated. And in that sense, when you force a reevaluation of one of those things by creating a situation where an inequity now tumbles that one down the pike and going down from ability all the way down to obligation, or from desire all the way down to responsibility, as you do that, it then gets down to that level of subconscious and begins to unravel that balance, which causes the other